At the Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast, you know we're big fans of our show sponsor, EQ Bank. They help Canadians make bank with high interest and no fees on everyday banking. But we also love EQ Bank for their impressive savings and low-risk investment products, including some of the best GICs on the market. Now, I spend most of my time and money investing in real estate, but I wanted to diversify into something easy and low risk, but that still offered good returns at competitive rates. And I found that with EQ Bank's GICs. I recently bought a GIC to put some savings to work in a matter of minutes, and I did it from the comfort of my own home. Low risks, high returns, easy to buy. EQ Bank checks all of those boxes, so go and take advantage of some of the best rates on the market at eqbank.ca/GIC.
Welcome to the Canadian Real Estate Investor, where hosts Daniel Foch and Nick Hill navigate the market and provide the tools and insights to build your real estate portfolio.
We are back with one of our, I think, our most returning guest here.
First guest ever on the show.
First guest and now third, gracing us with his presence again, Mr. Sasha Kakuz of Greybrook, CEO over there, doing a lot of great things in both Canada and the United States. We've got a whole bunch of great questions for you, Sasha, because I know you keep a close eye to the market and have a lot of great data you're going to share with us. I think we'd like to start things off with just, 30,000 feet. What are you seeing right now? Obviously, volatility in the market, consumer sentiment's been all over the place, rising interest rates, cutting interest rates, kind of give us your two cents on where we are right now.
Yeah. So if I had that answer, we'd all be a lot happier. I'll give you my version anyway. I think if you really go up to 30,000 feet and take into account the last 5 years, I feel like what we're seeing today is not altogether unpredictable, right? If you think about what happened in the beginning of the pandemic and interest rates dropping to zero, which, was not sustainable even at the time, what that did to asset values, real estate, especially, and the influx of buyers into that period of time, whether it were FOMO, whether it was, taking the opportunity, regardless, we crammed a lot of buying activity into a short period of time. And part of that was borrowed from the future, right? People that were probably planning purchases or investments down the road that looked at the conditions at the time saying, well, when is it ever going to get better than, zero or near zero interest rates? And I feel like the market's going to get away from me if I don't participate today. So I feel like we borrowed some of the usual cadence we'd see in future years and brought them forward. So today we're dealing with the reverse conditions where, we're dealing with the hangover of ultra low interest rates, and the pace at which they've increased has been record setting. People have had to adjust to that, not only in real estate, but in their lives, with inflation and the cost of living today. So the way I kind of look at it is we've largely adjusted pretty well, like notwithstanding what people may point to in the market and say, look, it's slow, it's anemic, it's not functioning the way that it should. With the conditions precedent, I'd say we're doing okay, to be perfectly honest. And people have just been kind of hanging on and waiting for a signal that, the worst is over and interest rates should start to gear down. I think the Bank of Canada has a pretty decent shot at engineering a soft landing as they intended to. I don't know if it'll be as soft as they wanted it to. I think it's still going to be a little bit bumpy, but I do think, we're seeing the front end of a pretty aggressive campaign to gear down interest rates. And I think for the real estate market, what that means is that activity should start returning. I mean, we're already seeing in the markets that we operate in Canada, on the ground related housing side that is more end user driven in pre-construction, we're starting to see activity return. That's because the people who need housing, right? They're it's for their own use. They are looking at the opportunity. They're looking at the messaging of the Bank of Canada, and they're starting to get more comfortable to get back into the market. Investors, on the other hand, you know, on the high-rise market where it's more investor-driven, there's still a lag, and I think there's still going to be a lag for a period of time. So I think we're starting to see the beginning of a stabilization of the market. It's just going to be a little bit longer with high-rise product, in my opinion, than it is with the low-rise product. But I think we're 70% through the worst of it, 80% through the worst of it. So I'm optimistic, to be perfectly honest with you, about what we have ahead of us.
Awesome. Excellent insights there. Do you have any thoughts on the changes that we saw from CMHC yesterday, I guess, with, you know, like, does that, given a lot of the challenges that you outlined and the fact that we're seeing a bit of an organic return to activity as prices come down, rates are coming down, you know, affordability is returning, buyers can reenter the market. One of the big things for me is the 30-year M for all new home buyers. You know, first-time buyers is obviously a big portion of the market, but I think that a lot of this was aimed at stimulating construction activity. Do you think that, you know, that an element of the policy side is trying to save the housing market from falling a little bit or propping it up? And if so, do you think that it'll be successful in doing that?
Yeah, I think, so the answer to your question, do I think it'll be successful? I think it will have some impact. I mean, I don't think it's going to get us all the way there to solving our problems by any stretch. I think it's a step in the right direction in the sense that anything that can assist with affordability of housing in any market is going to be a positive, right? So extending amortizations, check. It just makes it more achievable for the buyer. The second factor that was kind of one of the big changes was the allowance of insured mortgages up to 1.5 million. I think that's also in a lot of markets going to help, maybe less so in a Toronto market, for example, but around the country, I think it should have a positive impact. Why I don't think it solves all of our problems is that, you know, I think at the end of the day, policy is only a piece of it. And I don't think that the feds are looking at how to save the housing market. I don't think that their concern is that. I think their concern is the fact that we have finally, after many years of the industry trying to kind of hammer this home, have identified supply side factors as one of the main drivers of the affordability crisis that we live through. And unless we address those supply side factors, we're not going to solve the problem. Unfortunately, the market conditions are such that it's not really, no matter what you do policy wise, until interest rates start to come down and activity starts to return to the market, you're not going to see a lot of construction. So I think if you want to address these supply side factors, you have to stimulate construction. And this is one of the ways to try and do it. And that's why they, I think, aim the gun specifically at new home buyers, because they're trying to get the industry back on solid footing, not so much because they care about the profitability of the development industry or what it does to Canadian GDP. I think that's a part of it, but they also have to solve their problem. And right now we're falling even further behind, right? If you think about it, 2 years ago was really when the light started to shine on this supply side problem. So a bunch of things came in, right? You know, the Ford government in Ontario came in with a whole fair housing, not the fair housing plan, that was the prior administration, the housing affordability task force, which I was one of the contributors to. They came with all these policy matters, and then the market kind of crapped out. So it's like, you know, you guys heard the political tagline of like, we're going to build 1.5 million homes in the next 10 years. Sure, policy might have started to shift to be able to enable that, but then the market turned into a place that really couldn't deliver that. So now they're doing whatever they can to try to stimulate it.
Yeah. I mean, let's keep talking about that supply side, because, you know, that is exactly where you live and what you're trying to help, you know, Canada out with. So do you feel that some of the zoning changes across the country and in a lot of the major markets, whether it's just increased density or the, you know, major roads, major transit hubs, that kind of stuff, do you think that that is going to have a major effect on creating more of that supply, especially for, let's say, you know, obviously Greybrook does huge, you know, towers and big mid-rise stuff. And I mean, you guys have your hands in a lot of different types of construction and development, but for the smaller mid-cap investor, do you think that's going to make a difference there? Or are we still too far off on construction costs and availability of labor and materials and that kind of stuff?
I think it will make an impact. I do think the factors you sort of just referenced are real, and they are going to cause some drag on the ability for the industry as a whole, what big or small, to be able to deliver on that supply side. Again, I'm going to be saying this probably a lot, but it is a step in the right direction. Like I've been at this for 20 plus years, and we've lived through a lot of time where people didn't really think it was a supply side problem, right? So I'm encouraged by the fact that now everybody's eyeballs are on the actual problem, and legislators are looking at different ways to enable supply to increase. What I'd say, and having been part of the process to some degree, is there's a will and an intent, but it's still politics at the end of the day. So what starts out with a vast amount of recommendations that the industry might give, because we know it at a more granular level as to how to unlock some of these opportunities, it gets watered down, right? Because at the end of the day, it still has to pass. It has to have support from different points of legislation. So we got to a point that I think is okay. But again, there are other headwinds, as you identified, Nick. Cost being the most primary. Like if you look at where pre-construction condo is today in Toronto, to use a reference point, there's a standoff, right? The price, if you look at statistics, the price of unsold inventory hasn't really moved a heck of a lot, but sales volumes are like at historical lows. Well, why is there such a gap? Like people would think to themselves, well, it's not rocket science. Why don't you just lower your price and meet the market? Or, you know, yeah, it's not that simple, right? Because the costs have elevated over time to such a degree that this is where you have to be able to sell in order to make it economically feasible. And that doesn't come from a Sasha trying to preserve his return. That comes from how it's financed, what the banks require in terms of margin to lend construction loans. So there's a number of things in the ecosystem. And I think the way that this manifests over time is, you know, we're in a margin-based business, this production of housing business. The good news is we need housing, right? So we're not living in a market where there is no need for housing, and where our product, nobody wants our widget, so to speak, right? There's a lot of people who want our widget. So either price with macroeconomic change is going to start responding to that, and you'll have workable margins and you'll be able to deliver your widget, that being a house in my analogy, or if every Canadian has spent their last marginal dollar on housing, which I don't believe to be the case, but let's say it was, then you're going to start seeing those cost side factors respond, right? And you're going to start seeing some heat come off labor markets and infrastructure, you know, because nobody's building anything, right? Like think about the last couple of years, like we've had not a lot of activity, and we're already starting to see in my world, some of the front end trades moderate in terms of overall cost. So one way or another, you're going to start seeing workable margins. And for that mid-cap investor, as you sort of alluded to, I do think there's an opportunity here. And I do think that legislation, while today's macroeconomic conditions are such that you're not able to take advantage of those opportunities, that legislation isn't going to go backward, right? So the progress that we made when the macroeconomic conditions start to settle, I do think there's an opportunity for the smaller investor to take advantage of some of these rule changes around, missing middle development and intensification on smaller sites and things like that. And I think that'll be one of the great ways that we can actually start solving some of our supply side problem.
Yeah. For me, travel is all about new experiences and making memory with friends and family. My go-to is always an Airbnb, finding a cozy cottage, a jungle retreat, or a loft in one of my favorite cities to make the most of my adventures. On a recent trip, I realized my home was just sitting empty while I was away, so I started hosting on Airbnb, and now I have a steady stream of additional income. Since starting to host, I am now able to take more guilt-free trips because I can make money while I'm away. Why not let others enjoy your home while you're on vacation? Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.ca/host.
Harry Rosen is about helping men look and feel their best on any occasion. Whether it's taking clients out or an outfit for the next networking event, they have an extensive range of products from both new and established designers, all rooted in quality. Find your Harry Rosen style with one of their trusted advisors in-store or online now. Harry Rosen, for a life well-dressed. So a little bit more on the supply side, right? So you mentioned that there had been a lot of suggestions from industry leaders such as yourself to, you know, government organizations and the governing bodies kind of behind this, the, you know, the keepers of the red tape, we will say. What are some of those, would you say, like the most important suggestions that the industry has provided that maybe have or haven't been met or haven't been well enough received or implemented?
Well, one of the ones that I've mentioned, and you know, this may be a controversial subject because, you know, but it is what it is. I feel that part of the process, like you could get policy right, but the problem is that there's different levels of government that all have a hand in this, and they're not all that well coordinated, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Right. If you think about some of today's challenges and why, you know, there's been a lot of focus and attention on immigration levels, right? Really, it's because the infrastructure hasn't kept up with the level of growth. And if one of these things is a federal policy, that being immigration, and the other thing falls to, I wouldn't even say the province, it falls to the municipalities at the end of the day. That's where the rubber hits the road in terms of housing production and development. And there's been a misalignment, and now we're living with the result of that. I would say that coordinating better amongst the different levels of government is an important thing, and I just don't see enough of that. So I think there's a miss there. And I think, and this is a controversial piece, I think, because people don't typically respond well when I say things like this, but there's too many cooks in the kitchen, right? Like,
oh, for sure.
You know, and I use this analogy, and maybe it's a dumb analogy, but like if you had a massive sinkhole in the middle of Yonge Street in downtown Toronto, you wouldn't have 53 community meetings and ask for 100 different opinions before you fix the sinkhole, because it's critical infrastructure and it cripples your city and your infrastructure and your ability to exist and do business. I see housing also as critical infrastructure. And sometimes it's not the policy, it's how policy gets executed and the inertia of that process, whether it's bureaucracy, whether it's involvement with other stakeholders. Like, and by the way, look, I'm the first thing from an autocrat, like I'm not suggesting we should just go and be able to do whatever we want as an industry, but there has to be a more efficient way. And, you know, I'll give you an example. Like one of the things that we, or I specifically, and others probably with me, mentioned was around the appeals process and who can file an appeal to a development application and under what circumstances. And are there any barriers to this appeal? Like as it was like there's no cost. You can basically file an appeal if you have standing, if you're in the constituency, if you're a neighbor, if you have any concern or objection. That appeal, because the whole system's a little bit gummed up, it may be frivolous, it may not have a lot of merit, but it'll still take many months to resolve, right? And you're just adding more time and more cost as you go. So we suggest, well, maybe there's different barriers or consequences to an appeal that fails. And that might reduce the amount of, you know, frivolous appeal or things like that. And people don't like touching that. That's a thorny subject, right? So people don't like kind of going down that path. But I do think it needs to be addressed. And I think the way it has been addressed isn't even political. It's the PR around supply side challenges. And I think that if I was 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago at a community meeting, you'd get a lot of opposition for a number of reasons. Today, there's an equal amount of opposition and an equal amount of support. And that support is coming from people who have heard the message that, man, we're not building enough houses. Maybe we're the problem. Maybe we need to stop objecting to every development, every, you know, bit of density that somebody's trying to. The amount of times I've argued over like 10 meters, which is to the eye not even noticeable and has no impact on anything really, is insane.
Yeah.
That's starting to kind of like become a less of an issue. So I do think we're making progress.
Yeah, that's great to hear. I've just before Dan jumps in, I got to say, I do love that example. The Canadian housing economy is pretty much feels like a sinkhole at some points over the last couple of years. So yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the NIMBYs progressing towards that's something I probably never thought of. I didn't have that on my bingo card for this year. No. You mentioned kind of like smaller investors earlier on. One of the big themes right now is, you know, the market seems to be really scary and risky for a lot of investors. And you know, we've always been saying, like, as a lot of this risk starts to materialize is when you want to be, you know, the buy when there's blood in the streets, right? But a lot of people, either the blood is their own blood, which is, you know, it's part of the quote as well. And so they're afraid to, or I think, you know, Canadian real estate seems to be, it's definitely an unsophisticated buyer at the margin. And so, you know, you look at Canadian mutual fund flows, right? Like they perfectly illustrate that Canadians will time the top and the bottom perfectly to their disadvantage, right? So they'll all buy when the market's about to drop, and they'll all sell when the market's about to recover. With all of that being said, like, I think people need a healthier approach to what risk is and how to create opportunity from a bad investment environment. You know, what would you recommend, given that I would say you're probably among the most experienced people in the real estate space from an investment perspective, for people who still want to invest in real estate, but are having a hard time getting a handle on the risk environment?
You make a great point. And, you know, first of all, I unfortunately, it's not only Canadians that have that psychology. I think it's just human nature, right? I mean, people are emotional beings, and when it comes to finances and risk, it's a very emotional thing, right? So when you're hearing and reading and seeing, and, you know, yeah, of course it's nerve-wracking. It's hard to divorce your logic from your emotion in any market. The way I would, you know, is there blood in the streets today? Like, yeah, but it's honestly, it's not as bad as you might be hearing and reading. Like, a market that is just not buoyant. Like, today we have a very slow market. Nobody's buying resale. Nobody's buying pre-construction condo. Construction costs are high. The market is jammed, but we all know why, right? So it's not like out of the world of problems you can have as an investor, the worst is, I don't know why nobody wants to buy what I'm selling. That's the worst problem. And that's not a problem we have. And to me, the way I distill that is the fundamentals are still very, very strong. We have a scarcity of housing. That's not going away. That's going to continue. That's a great backdrop. Now, from here, it's trying to kind of understand how to participate in this growth and what we're ultimately going to see, which is better markets in the future. I would say that the last thing somebody should do is DIY. And the reason... Look, I invest in equities, obviously, outside of my own. I mean, predominantly, obviously, my wealth is tied up in my business and real estate or whatever. But to diversify, you have some money in other things. And I don't manage my own equity portfolio, because what the hell do I know about equities, right? Like, I'm not sitting there crushing charts all day and like following company news. But there's people that do that and do it well. And I find out who those people are and I give them my money. So I feel like, very similarly, if you're looking for exposure in today's market, whether you're sophisticated or unsophisticated, it is not the relevant point. The point is that if you are, like, take us, for example, as a firm, we are plugged into all the banks, we're plugged into all the different trades, we have 110 projects going on at once. There's a lot that goes on in terms of, you know, you have to have a balance sheet. You have to be like, why aren't we bleeding in the streets? Because we're fortunate to be properly capitalized, and we have the liquidity to be able to deal with issues. Not everybody has that luxury. So it becomes very important to work with people you believe are capable and trustworthy and know how to navigate this. And whether you do it directly or not, like, people like us are a passive investment. If somebody just wants to, like, not even think about it and just give us their money, and that's us. However, you can still invest directly, right? Be a hands-on real estate investor, right? Buy a fourplex, buy a, you know, home to renovate or value add it. You can do all those things. You still should have expert advice, right? Like, people should be listening to this podcast. They should be trying to get a hold of you guys and saying, look, What do you think I should do? Can you help me? Can you put me in touch with the right specialists in my market? That's what I'm a big believer in that. And, you know, I don't feel that I'm a hypocrite when I say it, because in real estate, yeah, we do it ourselves because we're in this business. But in every other thing I invest in, I don't try to do it on my, in fact, I've tried to do it on my own and failed miserably, right? Which is why it's like everybody hears that, oh yeah, should I be buying NVIDIA right now? Like, what do I know, right? Like at the end of the day, you know who knows? Like Scotia or whoever, right? Like, and so I'm a big believer that people today, if they're inclined to invest, which I believe they should be given the time and the fact, like I said, I think we're 70, 75% of the way through this thing and there's going to be a lot of opportunity, but they should just find the right people to do it with.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, Sasha, every time I've tried to go in and get creative in the stock market, I'm like, oh, here's this mining company that I heard something about and, you know, how to make a couple $1,000 disappear in the thin air, take my stock investing advice. You know, I think it really goes back to the principle of who, not how, right? It's that simple principle of find people that are doing it better, that live and breathe that, right? Like, I don't want to do my own accounting because I can pay someone who I can bring onto my team and they're going to do a substantially better job and figure out nuances that I could spend years trying to do and save a couple bucks. But if I can dish it out to a professional, then I get to go back and spend more time on what I'm really good at.
Yeah. And let me give you a real example, and I won't use any names, but I met a year and a half ago with a very small group of people in our industry with a major Canadian bank and their leadership. And one of the questions that came up was, okay, we all know what's about to happen, right? We got to start gearing up interest rates. We, you know, how are you guys seeing this differently than 08, 09, right? The global financial crisis. There were two key takeaways that I got out of that discussion. One of them was, unlike 08, 09, which was a liquidity crisis, like you actually had banks and institutions hoarding liquidity to shore up their own balance sheets. That's not the problem. We have a very stable banking system. The US has a very stable banking system. There's no systemic risk to the banking system. There's a lot of liquidity just waiting on the sidelines because the conditions are such that it's not ripe for investment just yet. But when those conditions start to change, there's going to be a lot of liquidity piling back into the market. So that was one of the biggest things. The second was they said, you know, we learned a lesson in coming out of 08, 09. What happened in 08, 09 is we changed all the parameters for everybody. We said, okay, here's how we're changing ratios on loans. We're changing criteria. We're changing debt service coverage ratios. We're doing everything to be able to protect ourselves. And whether you're Nick, the gigantic industry player, or Dan, the very small player,
wow, everybody's absolutely correct.
Everybody's getting the same treatment. And what they learned coming out of it was they ended up just pissing off their biggest and most experienced customers because they ended up obviously surviving and thriving. Only they were pissed because they went back to their lenders saying, well, you basically changed the rules of the game on me halfway through, and that's not cool. So I went to your competitor. And the ones that were very small fringe players, they ended up dying anyway, right? Like, and so what they said that they would do differently is that they would look at the landscape in a very different way and try to work with the biggest and best in almost as consistent a way as they could to try and get through this together. And then, you know, that's where relationships matter a lot. So to the point that you guys were making in terms of finding the biggest and best around, it's markets like this that matters a lot, right? Like it matters a lot because there's a lot of, you know, when you're working with a bank, for example, and you have $3 billion of outstanding construction loans with them, you're probably going to try to reach, you know, compromise on certain things, and you're going to have a different seat at the table. So I think for investors, big or small, you know, getting the right partners around the table, whether they want to do it passively by just, you know, using their RSPs and putting it with people like us, or whether they want to do it actively and work with people like yourselves and figure out how to make great investments. Either way, you need experts.
Yeah. Excellent insight. I think like it's one of the big things we talk about too, is just like building that team, and whether it's like outsourcing your entire investments to someone like yourself or creating the team around you to make it so that you can successfully go out and buy your own stuff. For me, travel is all about new experiences and making memory with friends and family. My go-to is always an Airbnb, finding a cozy cottage, a jungle retreat, or a loft in one of my favorite cities to make the most of my adventures. On a recent trip, I realized my home was just sitting empty while I was away, so I started hosting on Airbnb, and now I have a steady stream of additional income. Since starting to host, I am now able to take more guilt-free trips because I can make money while I'm away. Why not let others enjoy your home while you're on vacation? Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.ca/host.
Harry Rosen is about helping men look and feel their best on any occasion. Whether it's taking clients out or an outfit for the next networking event, they have an extensive range of products from both new and established designers, all rooted in quality. Find your Harry Rosen style with one of their trusted advisors in-store or online now. Harry Rosen, for a life well-dressed.
On that note, and maybe just like a quick answer here, because I know Nick has some curiosities around, you know, we're getting a lot of Canadians starting to be interested in the U.S. And I know you have some insight and experience in that market. But if you were a new investor today, I know you guys are dealing in the millions, tens of millions. If you were not in that position and somebody just said, hey, you have a budget of $1 million, maybe you got, you know, 300K equity cash to put out, right? And plus debt. What would your move be? What would you be buying today given the circumstances in Canada?
In Canada, I mean, like we were talking a little bit before we started the formal podcast, Nick and I, as you were putting your makeup on, Dan, and we were talking about, you know, Saskatoon and some of the opportunities that exist in a smaller market like Saskatoon. I think that, you know, oftentimes the Canadian market is so focused on the Torontos and Vancouvers and now more recently kind of Calgary and Montreal. But like, generally speaking, there's a lot of markets that are ignored that also are growing, also require housing, also have different economics that I think are even today work reasonably well, right? So I think that if I were an investor today at a smaller scale, well, $1 million isn't that small a scale, but I'd start looking at some of those. Again, I wouldn't do it myself. I try to figure out how to get in touch with people that can help me navigate those markets because they have coverage there, or have knowledge there. So that's one way. And then the second way, I think, you know, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I'd buy a pre-construction condo, you know, somewhere in the peripheral Toronto area. And I don't mean like Milton. I mean like the Queensway or, you know, these like just off the core grid, but on transit. There's a big step down in the per square foot price compared to like, right, let's say by Ryerson University or whatever the case is. But at the end of the day, there's, I believe, more upside there. And I think we're at a low point in the market. And I think from here, you know, we're going to regain our stability. We're going to see rent growth. We're going to see all the things that we used to see because there's that need, and that need isn't going away. So I think it's a good time to be doing that. So those are the two things I'd focus on. If I'm going to stay in big markets like Toronto, I'd think construction condo. If I'm agnostic to markets, I'd start looking at some of these smaller markets.
Yeah, I think the condo one is such a contrarian take in today's market, but I think it is like one of the things that people are sleeping on. And for me, like prices would have to be pretty compelling for me to get into that. But I think that on the one-off cases, like a lot of people don't think about a market that's falling, like the blood in the streets thing, in the way that they should. They're all thinking, I'm going to wait for prices to hit their bottom. Like I need to visibly see it on a chart that, okay, we're at the bottom, and then it starts returning. And now all of a sudden I'm buying, you know, at the bottom. They don't think about the people who are, you know, getting these distressed assignments or getting these power of sales or, you know, negotiating those deals so that the sellers are coming down 10% or 20% from their asking price. And that ends up being the data point that it, you know, it is the comp that creates the bottom. That is what, you know, and I think the people who are aggressive with their acquisition strategies on the way down are going to be the ones who benefit the most on the way back up.
Totally agree with you.
Nick, I know you had some thoughts on the US here, and we'll finish up with that. So, I mean, I'm curious to know as well, because I think like one of the big things that we see a lot of is Canadians thinking like, oh, opportunity's gone in Canada. We did a full analysis on it. I think like the especially your fringe markets in Canada versus the US, I think fundamentals are actually maybe more compelling here than kind of like flyover country in the US. But go ahead, Nick, and then I'm very curious to hear the thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, not much more to add to it. I guess just, you know, again, there's the Canadian sentiment that, you know, that makes it into some mainstream media that you can't invest in real estate here anymore in Canada, which is just entirely not true. And that, you know, that markets and tax structure and availability of labor and materials and all these things are just so much more ample in the States. And, you know, again, as Dan was just saying, you know, we've done a lot of research on that to essentially prove that wrong to a certain extent. And, you know, I know you've got your hands in a bunch of markets in both sides of the border, right? Down south in the USA as well as across Canada here. And I'm just wondering, can you maybe shed some light on some of the challenges and the opportunities and maybe the similarities and the differences that you're seeing kind of not with just the markets, but even just with the two countries? I know that's a tough one because it's such a big question, but yeah. Any kind of insights on that I think would be really valuable for not only Dan and I, but for our listeners.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you guys that, you know, anybody who thinks Canada's over and you shouldn't be investing, like that's just garbage. I mean, it's like when I was having, you know, podcasts back in at the beginning of COVID being like, okay, so now that cities are done, what do we do?
Yeah.
Right? Really, man? Like you're going to be looking backwards being like, oh, yeah, really? Did I think that? So here's how I would characterize it kind of super high level just to make it efficient. Everything we love about the U.S. or we think we love about the U.S., right? The quicker approval timelines, more availability of labor and infrastructure in some cases, growth of cities, you know, places like Miami, we're active in Atlanta, big sort of corporate centers. They are a double-edged sword. And what I'll tell you is that notwithstanding the volatility of the macro economy today, we have a forever imbalance of demand versus supply in Canada. I cannot stress how important, out of all the factors, that is the most important factor, period. What you see in America is that timing becomes a lot more important because migration patterns are very different. Immigration patterns are very different. First of all, Canada on an absolute, you know, relative to our population base, way higher level of immigration. The bigger factor, though, is the fact that, you know, you have 40 metros in America that have over 2 million people. So you can live a pretty urban lifestyle in 40 different cities. You simply do not have that opportunity in Canada. So people that come and immigrate to Canada, they're concentrated in certain cities primarily, which compounds that supply-demand imbalance. The amount of times U.S. markets can turn on a dime in terms of people coming in versus out, like to use Toronto as an example, like you're never going to have negative population growth in Southern Ontario. Never is a long time, but you know what I mean, right? Like that is not something that we're going to see in the near term. One election, and you could see a total reversal of migration trends in the U.S. Americans tend to be more transient. The corporate culture is different. People are, the amount of Americans I know, of friends and relatives that are like, I was born in Chicago, I went to school in LA, and I work in New York. Like in Canada, it's like, I was born in Toronto, I went to Western, which is super exotic, and now I work in Mississauga, right? Like, and that, yeah. We have a different, we're built a little differently. So why that matters is that markets get a bit overbuilt sometimes in the U.S. There's not a lot of pre-construction markets, so they're mainly spec built, right? Meaning they're built and then these units are sold. That's why during 08, 09, you saw a whole bunch of buildings that were empty because they weren't able to sell them after they built them, and that was a different issue. But what tends to happen is in times of euphoria, in times of growth, liquidity is plentiful. You know, there's exuberance and abundance on the development side, and a lot of stuff gets built. And then if there's some macroeconomic shock that changes migration trends, or, you know, it's an election or taxes or whatever it is, now you're left with like all this inventory that you can't clear out. And that can take a long time to clear out, right? Like a market like Phoenix, for example, the global financial crisis disrupted the growth that was happening in Phoenix, and it took a full 8 years for prices to get to back to where they were pre-global financial crisis. That's just not something we're going to deal with in Canada. So I don't want to sound bearish on the U.S. I'm saying that you have to be very careful and you have to be better with your timing. And that's where I think professionals should be doing it, whether it's, you know, you're investing in a REIT that has U.S. exposure, you're investing, you know, alongside guys like yourselves that have studied these markets or people like us. Don't do it yourself. Canada, on the other hand, I think has just much more intact, I don't want to say pedestrian fundamentals. Like they're much more pronounced and they're not easy to disrupt.
Yeah, I love that.
I think that's it for me. I got a lot out of this.
Make anything you want to add? Questions for like so now that the three of us have figured it all out.
Yeah,
we need to get out there and impart our wisdom.
That's it. Any final thoughts or anything you want to leave us with, Sasha?
The only thing I want to, you know, I've said it every opportunity I've had is that, you know, this is a moment in time. And I think that the luxury I get out of this period of time is the fact that the conditions precedent are such that what's happening is we can see exactly why it's happening. And the fact, again, I keep stressing the fact that we have this fundamental scarcity, which is of all the factors, the most important. So I think we just got to be patient as an industry. We have to be patient as investors and just sort of be smart, surround yourself with pros, and just be patient.
Sound advice from a very wise man. Sasha, thank you so much for gracing us a third time.
Third time's a charm.
I guess this is going to be our first annual reoccurring guest here. So, We'll put the links to Sasha and to Greybrook if anyone's interested in investing alongside them. They are complete professionals in the industry and have a wide array of investing opportunities for people to get involved in. So Sasha, sincere thank you from both Dan and myself. And again, every time we talk to you, I definitely learn a thing or two as well. So thank you, and we'll chat with you soon.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Thanks.
The Canadian Real Estate Investor Podcast is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not financial advice. Nick Hill is a mortgage agent with Premier Mortgage Center and a partner in the G&H Mortgage Group. License number 10317, agent license M210040037.
Daniel Foch is a real estate broker licensed with Rare Real Estate, a member of the Canadian Real Estate Association, the Toronto Real Estate Board, and the Ontario Real Estate Association.